Welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 326. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are James Jones.
Hello.
And Guillaume Veillette.
Be my Valentine.
John Lindemann is not here right now. He got held up at work, but we're hoping he's going to drop in a little bit later. And, of course, we do have a special guest this week, so please welcome our old friend, Plan A, Mr. Billy Berghammer.
Hello. I'm sure Lindy's actually, he's busy reviewing games.
Yes.
He's catching up on some slacking reviews, but thanks for having me. I do want to apologize for not being part of the Zelda discussion, as I promised during the telethon that I would help with that. I did not foresee that I would be busy launching a game.
Well, you didn't promise. You just said you'd like to, and I invited you.
I'm pretty sure I promised. I said, hey, if we make the goal of the money, I promise I'll play through Majora's Mask. And yeah, now I feel like a real dick.
But so. We had Greg on, which was a total surprise. We didn't expect that. So it worked out really well. I don't know if you've heard it, Billy, but it turned out really, really well. And did you ever end up playing through Majora's Mask?
No.
You should definitely still do that one day.
You know, I had, you know, I even busted out the game, like I found it and I was like, cool, you know, and then I put it on the shelf and then, you know, one thing led to another and things got pretty crazy with Skulls. And so I just, yeah, I have a lot of catching up to do when this project is over. So.
Well, I'm sure Majora isn't at the top of your list, but I'm telling you, one day it's one of those kind of bucket list games that you really should play sometime because as we discussed on the live show, there's really not anything else quite like it, for better or worse. I say for better. There are arguments to the contrary, but it is a very unusual, special game for sure.
Well, yeah, for better, there are not more games like this one. I agree.
I still say I would bet $100 easy that Majora is going to be announced for 3DS at E3 this year.
I don't know about E3, but. Eventually, it will happen.
Yeah, they're pretty Zelda'd out this year, to be honest.
With the Wind Waker remake, I don't know that they want another Zelda remake in the same year.
I don't know.
Probably releasing around the same time.
I'm not saying it won't happen, but I think eventually, for sure. It's a very natural fit. It's a game that really needs to be remade in terms of the technology and the accessibility of it. I think there's a lot you could do in a remake that would make it a little bit easier for people to appreciate. So anyway, we have a special episode for you, really. This is going to be a shorter episode, mainly because James and I are editing again this week, and last week's 2.5-hour marathon pretty much killed us. I know it did me. So we are aiming for a much shorter episode this week. We're going to go for one segment, but we want to make it a really good one. So we're going to do something special here. We're going to do one of our patented feature topics, and we're going to talk about strategy games on Nintendo consoles. I think it's going to be a pretty interesting discussion. There are more examples of this than you might realize, and including some of them that we are familiar with among this group. But first off, the reason that I wanted to have Billy on at this time of the year and to talk about this topic is because, as he mentioned, he just helped launch Skulls of the Shogun from 17-bit. It's on. Well, Billy, give him the spiel. Tell him what Skulls is all about.
Sure, it's a
do your
action.
Fucking job.
Yes, I'm doing my job. I've talked enough
about
this
skulls.
Game.
Skulls.
Yes, it's about eating skulls. But seriously, it's it's a very well. I'll tell you know when we talk about you know strategy games. I mean, it's a fast-paced turn-based strategy game that I think feels more like a fighting game than you know a drawn-out real-time strategy game. It loses the grid. There's no, you know, that's one of the main conventions. One of, you know, I mean, there's a lot of different conventions for this type of game, but it, you know, it loses the grid. So there's more of a circular, space on the map that you can move your characters. There's, mm-hmm. You only have 5 moves. So you're not, you know, later when you're playing Advance Wars, when you've got like 20 different moves to do, you know, it takes a lot of time. So, It's a lot easier to pick up and play this game quick. You can save at any time, which, you know, say you're halfway through a battle and you just want to save and walk away. But the other thing that's really cool about it is that we've got this asynchronous gameplay for single player and multiplayer where, well, the game's out for Xbox Live Arcade, Windows 8, Surface, and Windows Phone. So if you have any of those devices, you can take your game on the go wherever you go. So you could be in the middle of a match on your Xbox, and so you need to, you know, hop on the train to go to work. You've got your Windows Phone. You know, you save your game to the cloud on your Xbox, and you can pick up and play on your phone or your Surface or even Windows 8. Multiplayer also, you can play asynchronously against anybody on any of those devices, which I think is really cool stuff. I think that's stuff that we're really going to see more of, you know, next generation. I mean, we're seeing it on PS3 with cross-buy, you know, and the games that you can play against each other on those two systems. And, you know, this is the first game that does it for Microsoft's, across all of Microsoft's, ecosystem. So I think it's cool.
You did hook me up with a copy of the Xbox version. I think even though the game unfortunately is not coming out on any Nintendo systems, it has a very, I mean, look, the studio's name is 17-bit, so you could probably get an idea that this looks a lot like a Super Nintendo game. It definitely is going for that kind of style. It's simple and arcadey in a way that I think Nintendo fans would appreciate. So I would say if you have one of the devices that the game is supported on, it's definitely worth checking out. And especially on Xbox, there's a free demo, you know, just like with any game. Definitely check that out.
Skip the demo, buy the game. It's well worth your money. you know, granted I'm biased, but, you know, but what you're saying about 17-bit, I mean, the studio, Jake Kasdell, runs the studio, and his favorite console is the Super Nintendo. I mean, he wants the whole theme behind the studio is taking those 16-bit experiences to the current generation or next generation, you know, with updated graphics, updated, you know, features like doing the async play across multiple platforms or things like that, but that little extra, but it's got that old school flavor to it.
And very specifically, he wants to make 2D games.
Yes. So, but it's totally got that flavor. And, you know, it's a lot more lighthearted. The writing is really good. I mean, I think it's hilarious. The characters are just really funny. So I think it's really fun to play. And, you know, the feedback that we've gotten, the reviews have been fairly solid, across the board. And, you know, the feedback that we've been getting from the community has been, it's been great. So yeah, it's been an interesting ride the last couple months. I've never launched a game before. And so, seeing how that all works from the other side is definitely fascinating. So
very cool, man. All right. So you got your plug and now we're going to put you to work.
All right.
But it's a very relevant plug, for this topic. And it's something I've been thinking about a lot, especially with Fire Emblem Awakening coming out on 3DS, and a lot of people are talking about it, a lot of people are enjoying it, including people who are playing Fire Emblem for the first time or are enjoying Fire Emblem for the first time, because the 3DS game is so much more accessible, and forgiving is probably a fair word, you know, not necessarily easier, but more forgiving, depending on the settings. And it just feels kind of like the right game at the right time for the right platform. You know, it's just kind of one of those magical confluences of events. So I figured with Fire Emblem being on people's minds and with, you know, a lot of us playing it too, it was probably a good time to look back at this genre, which I feel like, you know, Nintendo gamers in general probably aren't terribly familiar with strategy games, certainly not as much as PC gamers would be. Even on the other consoles, generally, I think they're more exposed to this kind of game than we are, because they get stuff like, you know, all the RTS games that got ported to 360, whether they're good or not, you know.
Right.
Yes. But Sony has had some really classic strategy games like Final Fantasy Tactics and the remake of Tactics Ogre and stuff like that, that are pretty well known on that platform, probably more so than they are on Nintendo systems.
Yeah, the PSP especially is just laden with these JRPG strategy games.
Yeah. What is it? Disgaea, you know, yeah. A lot of stuff like that. So that stuff, I mean, those series pop up here and there on Nintendo platforms, but they're not really known as Nintendo games. They're really known as PlayStation or Xbox games. So I thought, you know, actually, I started to think about it. I started to kind of list these out and think, is there enough material to even do this episode? And I was surprised at the number of games. So I kind of ended up splitting these up into three different categories based on chronology. And I figured, you know, maybe we could start with some of the oldest examples. And we may not have as much to say about this group because they're primarily very Japan-focused. In fact, maybe didn't even come out in the West at all. But some of them that I thought of were the original Fire Emblem, which was a Famicom game. I think it was maybe a 1990 Famicom game, so like really late, really technologically advanced.
It was a very sophisticated Famicom game, yes.
And then that series, I think, probably really became popular on Super Nintendo in Japan. Skipped N64 entirely, but then it made a resurgence on GBA, and that's when, you know, Nintendo of America finally started bringing them over. And it's developed slowly, but it has developed quite a following over here as well. And of course, you've got Famicom Wars. Now, this is a series that we, at least the early entries in this series, we have never seen. This, again, was, I think, a fairly late Famicom game back in maybe the late 80s. And it was really popular in Japan. Morphed into Super Famicom Wars, and then eventually 64 Wars, which I don't think ever came out. It was a 64 DD game. Billy, you would know better than the rest of us on that.
Yeah, no, I don't remember if that came out. I mean,
because they showed it at Space World one year, but then I don't think they ever finished it.
Yeah, the 64 DD had just a weird lineup. I don't
to say the least.
64 Wars did not come out. No.
When I got my 64, it came with a lot of the launch titles. There's like the hard to get ones that like I think Chris Kohler probably has and nobody else does
in the world.
But, yeah,
Doshin the Giant 2.
But yeah, I think the first time we ever really saw it was GBA, right?
Yeah, the first time in the West. So this, of course, became Advance Wars. And up to that point, each game in the series was named after the platform that it came out on, obviously. And then Advance Wars was such a mega hit and was the first game to come out around the world in Europe as well. And so the series kind of became rebranded as Advance Wars. And so even when they brought out the DS games, they still called them Advance Wars instead of DS Wars. But I 64 Wars has a special place in my heart because that was, you know, in probably 99 or 2000, that would have been the first time that I was exposed to that series because I had just gotten the internet and I was now reading about these events in Japan that I would never have known about before that. And when I heard about 64 Wars being one of the games they were showing for the DD, I was really interested in it. And then there was some context given that the series had been around ever since the Famicom and I'd never heard of it before. And I was really interested in it, but you know, they never really showed much of that game. But when Advance Wars was finally announced, I was like, oh, okay. So that's the next one in the series. Cool.
So 64 Wars is done by Hudson.
Oh, weird.
That is weird.
Huh.
I've used the magic of Googles and, I didn't know that. That's kind of crazy. But yeah, there's like unseat. I mean, if you Google it right now, you can see a bunch of footage, on it. Probably what you're referring to, Johnny. So.
Yeah. Well, I think I would probably only ever saw screenshots back then, but, I do actually want to go watch this later. So that's pretty cool. And then a couple other series that you've probably heard of. They've been around for a really long time. Koei's Romance of the Three Kingdoms, which is based on an ancient Chinese folklore, basically, or military history.
Based on the ancient Chinese story about, but basically called that. Well, depending on your translation.
Yeah, yeah. And they've basically remade and reported that game over the past 20 years. But I think a version did come out on NES. I want to say that was actually,
there was one localized NES game and like 87 Super Nintendo games.
Yeah, there definitely was on Super Nintendo, and I remember I actually saw a friend once playing this on Super Nintendo. I didn't understand what the hell was going on.
Did you punch the shit out of them? Because you should have.
I think he was just interested in trying it out. You know, it was one of those weird Japanese things that they really had made almost no effort to make it accessible for, you know, a Western audience. They just kind of translated it and shoved it out on the shelves. It was like one of those things you'd see in the rental store back in the 90s. And you're like, I've played everything else. I guess I'll try this, you know, and hope that it comes with a manual.
Can I speak to my experience with the Super Nintendo version of this game? It is absolutely the least accessible game ever made.
And this is on Virtual Console, by the way. You can try it for yourself if you dare.
Every word in this game could be written in Aramaic, and it wouldn't make any less sense. It's it's just stupid. I mean, there's a bunch of buttons at the top, and you pick the one you want, and then things happen, and you don't quite understand why. It's like, I'm going to buy horses from this daimyo, and then all of a sudden your relationship goes up. What does that mean? I don't know. Why do I have these horses? What do I do with them? Oh, this fucking game.
Is it possible I put it in the wrong category? Would you say
there's strategy component. It's more of a high strategy, so it deals with, you know, the management of the empire as well as the management of the battlefield. But the biggest strategy is just figuring out how to use the interface. I mean, I guess it's gotten better in the more recent ones, but that game, oh my god. It's the only game I've attempted about 12 times and have gotten nowhere with. It's just, oh, what is this?
So there was also Nobunaga's Ambition, which I think also did actually come out in the West, even back in the late 80s. Because I remember seeing it, I never knew what it was. You know, I remember the name because Nobunaga is really kind of sticks out when you see it on the box art. But I never knew what it was, and I never played it, and it wasn't until much, much later that, you know, I heard about the legend of Nobunaga, the Japanese general, and, you know, all the weird stuff that went on there. That's a kind of a supernatural story, I think.
Yeah.
So, of course, we'll talk about that later, but that does come up later in the story. But for the most part, I didn't want to spend too much time on this older era because I figured most of us probably didn't really get exposed to these games on Nintendo platforms.
Well, there's like, I think one of my first glimpses of a strategy game was on the NES, and it was, I've been trying to find exactly the title. The only thing that I could find that kind of looked like what I remember is Conflict. But in my mind, like, it looked better than Conflict does on screenshots, but that could just be, you know, the effects of, you know, like the time that's passed. In my mind, it looks more like Military Madness on the TG-16, but I never played that back in the day, so it can't have been that. But maybe, like, if listeners know of other X-based tank battles on the NES, I might have played that as well. I just remember being kind of, you know, not entirely understanding what was going on, because back then, I barely understood English. But the whole, you know, buying units and just, you know, gaining terrain and gaining ground and all of that was already kind of fascinating. You know, like back then was really unlike anything I had played up to then. It certainly wasn't Mario, so.
So back then, I would imagine one reason that strategy games weren't totally working on consoles, including Nintendo consoles, is that they didn't necessarily have the input devices that were appropriate for that kind of game, because generally you are kind of moving these small units around some kind of map. So that, you know, just a D-pad and two buttons is probably not the greatest way to do that. And the other part of it was, probably the screen resolution had something to do with it. You know, the amount of text that console gamers were expecting, especially with the arcade roots of most console games. I think the amount of, not even just exposition, but just tutorializing that is almost required to get into a strategy game, it probably didn't come across very well.
Well, that or the games were incredibly simplified.
Well, yeah, I don't know if there are a lot of examples of that. I mean, I think it came later. Famicom Wars is probably fairly simple, especially for that era. But I know back in this era, like in the late 80s, early 90s, I was probably more exposed to strategy games on PC.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not going to talk too much about other platforms, but there's definitely a big, giant river of parallel discussion that we could be having about strategy on PC because... and it does bleed over from time to time, as we're about to talk about, with the console stuff, even on Nintendo. But the strategy seemed at the time really much more appropriate for PC gaming, and I think that that assumption has gone away with time. And people are, even in the last 5 years, I think people have become a lot more amenable to trying a strategy game on a console.
Well, there was some experimentation on consoles. Like Doom 2, the first or one of the first real-time strategy games was on Genesis. And I'm not sure, but I think that that's perhaps the first time that I saw it. I saw my cousin playing it on the Genesis. Well, you know, like my memories aren't reliable on this, but definitely like it. And it can't have been that much harder to play than on PC because the game was so basic. And you could only like click one unit at a time, move it one at a time, and you had to click attack and then click the enemy units, or else nothing would happen. Good times.
I also think it's a tough sell, though. Like, I mean, you know, back in the day, you look at the box art, and it's got these big fucking tanks, and they're like, la, and like people like looking like they're fighting, and so you know, you're like, cool, I want that, and then you bring it home, and it's slower. It's not the, I mean, granted, you know, I mean, the graphics back then didn't really help the situation either, but like, I mean, it's just, it's a lot slower, and it's, you know, if you thought that you were buying this like action-packed, holy crap game,
yeah,
and then you get home and it's like, okay, this is kind of basically chess. And, you know, it takes really long, to, you know, especially later on in these games, it takes really long to, get through like one of the battles or one of the matches. You know, I think that can be a little frustrating for people that are impatient.
And, actually, speaking of chess, any of you guys ever play an NES game called Archon?
Of course.
That was a PC game too, though.
Yeah, it was on PC, but there was actually a very serviceable NES version. And yeah. I used to play that a lot because it's, well, Guillaume, why don't you describe it?
Well, it is chess. You know, you've got a, what is it, 64 square board, and, you just, move your light or dark armies, and when you reach an enemy, pawn or, well, when you reach the enemy, suddenly you're inside an arena and you use your powers against theirs. And, every different type, piece type has different attacks, and, it's, you know, kind of a mix of an action game and chess.
Yeah, and the action parts of it look kind of like Atari Combat. You know, it's this overhead thing, and you're just kind of
chasing each other around and trying to hit the other one, yeah.
This field will have some obstacles sprinkled through it, so you kind of have to go around the stuff and try to find a clear shot. And it was cool because, you know, it's basically, whereas in normal chess, if your piece attacks the other, basically if you're the one moving, then you will take the other piece, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter what their ranks are. So a pawn can defeat the queen, for instance. But in Archon, it was like, things were still balanced the same way. So the queen was still the most powerful unit in the game, but she could be beaten, in this action part of the game. So it also factored in the player's skill. And it was really fast paced. Surprisingly, the battle parts were like kind of hyper speed, actually, the action sections of the game. And so the whole thing went by really fast and it was really cool. And it also had this really kind of black and white visual style that I still thought was really cool, actually. So yeah, it's not on Virtual Console, but if you ever see a copy of Archon, it's Archon. I would recommend it. It's a pretty cool little game. And it was on PC, so maybe it's easier to find that way.
And there was a sequel.
Really?
Yeah, Archon 2. I've never played it, but I
never heard of it. Cool.
It's floating around.
We don't want to dwell too much on PC stuff, of course, but wanted to move on to the what I call the mid-era examples of strategies on Nintendo platforms. And I think things really kind of start to pick up here, as you'll see. This is maybe a decade-long kind of period of like maybe the second half of Super Nintendo stuff, along with the early 2000s. And so Ogre Battle kind of jumps right to mind, and James, I know you have a lot to say, but I mean, this would encompass really all three of the first Ogre Battle games.
Right.
So Ogre Battle, Tactics Ogre, and then Ogre Battle 64, which all came out in the span of about 5 years in the second half of the 90s.
And they're really two very distinct games going on in that, which sort of gives an interesting aside into the parallel of what strategy games on consoles tend to look like. I would say Tactics Ogre takes what is the more normative route, or at least now it is, for a strategy RPG on a console. It's one-on-one engagements. It's very much tactics heavy, which kind of is belied in the name. It's very much designed around making matchups, one-on-one duels that are favorable for your condition. understanding terrain and things like that versus a larger grand strategy of a full battle. It's more like managing individual conflicts.
Yeah, and it has a more RPG feel because you're interacting one-on-one with these characters, with these single individual characters. So you can develop their abilities, and then they start to differentiate, and they have different classes that match up in different kind of paper, rock, scissors, comparisons.
Yeah, on a larger scale, so as a more zoomed out view, not literally as in the scale is larger, but literally more zoomed out, that's the same place that Fire Emblem goes.
Yes.
It feels somewhat different, but they're effectively the same game. I think it's because they're less focused on the character. It's really the only difference is a camera angle.
Fire Emblem, I almost said Fire Emblem owes a lot to Tactics Ogre, but it's probably the other way around, isn't it?
Because yeah,
Fire Emblem
it is.
Predates Tactics Ogre by about half a decade.
Final Fantasy Tactics owes a lot to Tactics Ogre.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
In part because they took the people who made the game.
Yeah, it's made by essentially the same team. They were bought up by Square. But, and the original Ogre Battle, which is on Virtual Console along with the 64 game, I would recommend the 64 game. It's a lot easier to get into and easier to understand.
It is.
For some of the reasons we talked about, like, I think having a joystick in that kind of game where it's really not grid-based, you know, on 64, you're just kind of moving an arrow and pointing them where you want them to go, and then they move automatically. I think the joystick works nicely for that, especially with the 3D terrain, and I think there's just such a higher resolution that you can show more text. You can put more information on the screen
yes.
without it looking, you know, totally gibberish.
It looks pretty gibberish already.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, one thing we talked about when we did it for Retroactive is that in Ogre Battle 64, there are a lot of systems going on invisibly that you don't really have very much transparency into why these characters are behaving the way or developing their stats in the way that they are. That's much worse on Super Nintendo because they can't show as much information on the screen. So there's even more stuff that's kind of happening in the background.
Right.
And it becomes more inscrutable. It feels like you know, you're not really sure why you won that battle, or you're not really sure why this character won't gain more hit points as you play more and more battles with him.
Right.
But also the game was I don't think that the Ogre Battle 64 one had tarot cards, right?
Yeah, it did.
It did?
It had an interrupt system that is similar. It wasn't nearly as... I don't know what the best word to describe the Super Nintendo experience with the cards
Cheap.
Was. I was going to say absurdist. Yeah, it's less inclined to screw you badly.
Right.
But in both those games, it's sort of what Johnny alluded to, because it's not just zoomed out like the Fire Emblem games. You have a very detached feeling from the action on screen. You're not giving anyone specific orders, which in some of the more strategy or tactics oriented games you do, sometimes it's just attack each other. You're just setting them on a path. You're setting a general mission plan for how you want to carry out the order of operations. And you can make adjustments, but you really can't control the conflict beyond sort of just setting things in motion.
Ogre Battle is more like, it's more like being a real military general.
Right.
You can't be there to give commands to each individual soldier all the time. You have too much responsibility. So you have to zoom it out. You're basically looking at a map when you do your job as a general, right? And you're kind of just moving formations around and hoping that they fight well once they get to the enemy. Based on how you've trained them and, you know, how you've put them together and, you know, where you put them on the map and who they're facing. So, you really are just kind of telling them where to go, and then you watch them go there, and then you watch them fight, and you hope that it worked. And if it doesn't work, my problem with Ogre Battle is I usually don't understand why it didn't work, and so I don't know what to do differently. But I do like having the more, you know, micromanagement level of control.
Yeah. It's kind of weird that those teams made two really different types of games that quickly, but
yeah.
It's kind of an interesting... If you play one and try to play the other, you'll be really knocked for a loop if you don't know what you're getting into.
They're totally different.
Yeah.
But they're both strategy games, so...
Yes.
Interesting little trilogy there to talk about in this mid-era. You've also got... I don't specifically want to do this just for laughs, but you've also got StarCraft 64.
Yes, which I owned.
Oh, great. So, but I always actually wanted to play it, and by the time it actually came out in 2000, I think.
Yeah, 2000.
I just kind of didn't care anymore. I was super interested in this back in like 97, 98. And then it just took too long to make. But please tell me, what am I missing with StarCraft 64?
It's so goddamn weird to play. It really is. I mean, I've beaten the original StarCraft on the PC every which way one can possibly beat that game.
I'd forgotten that you were such a big fan.
I got to the point where I could savage the game pretty badly. But it you know, as if from a strategic standpoint, a lot of the games of that ilk mostly just feel like, all right, I need to get mining as fast as I can so I can build the most shit.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to worry about trying to do like formational sweeps or trying to outflank your enemy. You just need to basically overwhelm them with an armada of garbage.
Yeah, I think the strategies do get more nuanced than that, but that is kind of at the fundamental, because it's a resource gathering game.
Right.
Whereas a lot of these other ones, you start out with certain characters and you just hope that they all survive, right?
Right. You're not going to make a last stand of the 300 in StarCraft.
Right. StarCraft is like you start with often one character and then you make hundreds more characters.
Now, imagine that with like crazy zoom levels going on. And that's kind of what you're dealing with the N64 port. It felt really odd to play, and playing it with the controller felt really bizarre.
So is the camera just zoomed in really tight?
Kinda, yeah. I mean, keep in mind that the resolution of a PC monitor even then was much better than your TV.
About twice, yeah. Well, not even your TV, but the
N64, yeah.
The N64 couldn't actually output, for most games, it did 320x240, which was about half the resolution of an old, you know, standard definition.
Yeah,
TV.
So it looked pretty muddled. What was funny about the game was that the multiplayer mode?
It was split screen.
Yeah, it was split screen, which means
you
had...
Did you ever try that?
You had even... Yes, I did. Not only could you see what your opponent was preparing for you. In fact, it was unavoidable to stray into their area because it simply was... It was vertical.
You could see what they were doing the whole time.
It was horizontal split screen too, which was even weirder. So, the top half of the screen was yours, the bottom half of the screen was your opponent's. Now imagine that on a 4:3 TV, just trying to do half of a screen strategy. So you can't see most of your formation as they're marching, but you can see that shit's coming your way, so you better get ready for it. What was really funny is I played this with my cousin, and we agreed we weren't going to go on resource building binges. We weren't going to just basically, as the nomenclature is, Zerg Rush. We were going to try to be super duper tactical about this. So we're both, you know, being really careful with what we build. You know, I built a handful of siege tanks to just keep shit away. And then I went and built a ghost, which is this stealth individual who can go in and out cloaked. And ordered them to use the nuke on his base. I'm like, fuck this, I'm gonna get this shit over with. Except he could see the ghost on my screen and knew exactly where the hell it was. I just ordered one of his tanks to shoot that spot until they died. I was like, oh, you ass.
StarCraft 64 is one of those rare examples of a game that makes way more sense on paper than it does in execution.
It's the weirdest game I own.
Like in 1996 or 97, when Nintendo first scored this deal with Blizzard to put StarCraft, and it was exclusive. This is the only console that StarCraft will be ported to. StarCraft was a huge deal. I mean, yeah. this was like just a monster announcement. And then year after year, it became less relevant, and they obviously had tons of difficulty completing this version of it and actually making it playable, and it came on a giant N64 cartridge just to hold all the sprite data.
Oh, it was so expensive too.
Exactly, which translates into a very high price, and it required the expansion pack because it's made for PCs with much more RAM than N64 had.
You know, it works remarkably well considering all the reasons it should be a complete fucking disaster.
I really want to play this at PAX East now. We need to make this happen.
But the... You know, like the PlayStation had Red Alert and Command and Conquer.
Yeah. PS1 was a much better system for strategy games than N64.
Well, yeah, just because of a CD.
Even Command and Conquer on the PlayStation was not a good game.
No, it was a bad version, but at least...
It was a brutal port.
But at least they tried, you know. So moving forward just a little bit, although it's easy to forget just how close the N64 and GBA were, but moving ahead just a couple years to the GBA, it launched with a game that only came to Japan, I think, unfortunately. But I think, Billy, you might have played Napoleon at some point.
Oh, my God. Wow, that is a total blast from the past. I don't think I played it because I, you know, especially when you're – I already had at that time, I wasn't really too much into the strategy genre.
Yeah. Well, this was a super weird announcement because I think Intelligent Systems made Napoleon and it was shown at, you know, Space World in Japan. And there was a lot of buzz around it because people thought it was so weird that, you know, Nintendo was making a new strategy genre for GBA. And they're putting it on GBA, which really couldn't be less appropriate of a platform for a strategy game. The tiny little screen.
Virtual Boy. Maybe that's worse.
Yeah, but I mean, it's also, yeah. Oh, now I totally remember that. It's already hard enough to play a lot of games in Japanese. Even though throughout the years, especially with Planet GameCube, I definitely played a ton of them.
Lord knows I've tried.
But like, you know, once you're basically relegated to a lot of menus, then you're like, yeah.
Yeah.
Forget this.
And Napoleon is a real-time strategy game exclusive to the GBA, if you could believe that. And it was based on Napoleon. It was a historical war game, and I think you controlled fairly small numbers of troops. Maybe kind of more on the scale of a Company of Heroes rather than these giant StarCraft armies of, you know, hundreds of units. I was always very curious about it. Unfortunately, it never came to America.
But like the real-time strategy genre had been tried on the Game Boy Color, hadn't it?
Yes, there was that game that id Software made, right?
Yeah, Warlocked.
Yes.
That's another, I would love to try that sometime. Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't seem like a good idea, but...
It seems like the worst idea.
Well, yeah, it sounds like the kind of game that you play because it exists and there's really nothing else. Right? Like, you want to play a real-time strategy game, you've got a Game Boy. Well, there's only one choice.
Keom's existentialist game suggestions.
Anyway, I kind of want to play it for the same reason I do the old Resident Evil port for GBC that, you know, Capcom was prototyping.
Actually, real quick, funny, I just had to look up Napoleon just because I'm like, man, I remember this, but I don't. So Genki actually developed it for Nintendo. This is something that only saw the light of day in Japan, but it was compatible with the mobile adapter GB, which was what you could connect your Game Boy Advance to your cell phone in Japan.
Holy shit.
To play multiplayer, and it was released outside of Japan in one country. Can you guess which country it is?
France?
Yep.
I don't...
That's what? Perfect.
What?
Anyway, there's your story behind Napoleon. The game you'll never play.
What in the world?
We should import a copy for Guillaume and let him play it for us.
Send me games.
So, the other big one, of course, around this time was Advance Wars. So the System Wars, franchise finally came to the West and to GBA, which seemed kind of like the perfect marriage of platform and franchise. And this was huge for me because I'd sort of had fell off playing PC games in the late 90s, early 2000s. So I hadn't played any strategy games in a while, and I feel like Advance Wars really kind of brought me back to the genre and made me fall in love with it again.
The first time I saw it, I think, was when they showed it at E3, but this was when I was still doing Planet GameCube, but somebody like Nintendo was touring around with their like review units and things like that, and I think they were in Minneapolis when I was living there. And they brought this, it was coming out around the same time that Mario Kart was coming out on GBA. So they were showing press Mario Kart and Advance Wars. And I'd never played Advance Wars before or, you know, anything really that much like it. I played Ogre Battle, but I was like, holy crap, this is amazing. And like, I played Mario Kart for a while because like I had basically an hour and a half or something like that with him. I played Mario Kart for a good chunk because I'm a big Mario Kart guy, but once I started playing Advance Wars, I think he ended up being there for at least 2 hours because I just kept playing, like, and I'm like, man, I've never played anything like this before, and I mean, especially early levels of Advance Wars is really accessible, and they have a really good learning curve, I think, to get you in and just to show you the ropes, especially since that was the first time the game came over. But yeah, it was a new beginning for me, at least for that kind of game.
I think you can't overstate the importance of this, because we probably would have never gotten Fire Emblem if Advance Wars hadn't been a huge hit.
Truth.
And it did really well in the West, and I think it owes a lot to having, it's very accessible, the interface is really clear about where you can go and what will happen if you attack an enemy. And it's bright and colorful, so it's, you know, even though it has wars in the title, it doesn't, you know, it feels like something that anyone could play. So I think it had a kind of a little bit wider appeal than some of these hardcore Asian history military strategy games have had.
It's a bit cartoonish. I mean,
oh yeah.
I mean, the character designs are incredibly cartoony.
Even the like the tanks are cute.
Well, until they get blown up, then it's not so adorable.
But that has a lot to do with it, and the game's also really fast paced for a turn based game. You know, like the menus are quick to navigate, and the animations play out quickly, and it generally feels like you're doing a lot of stuff. You're moving a lot of units, and things are happening. But it all is paced very well. It's really nice and streamlined, I think.
To Johnny's point of the game probably assisting its intelligent systems brethren for making the jump, I think the positioning of the characters from that franchise in Smash Brothers probably also played a significant role in it.
Absolutely. Which would have been around the same time. Smash Brothers Melee came out, you know, right around the time of Advance Wars.
I have to imagine a lot of people who played Smash Brothers when they unlocked Marth. It's Marth Enroy, I believe. So when you
you say, who the fuck is Marth?
Who the fuck is this girl? And then you realize it's a guy. And then you're like, oh.
And then you find out he's really, really good in the game.
He's so overpowered.
And I'm sure that had a lot to do with it, you know?
Well, I think because, you know, Smash Brothers came out in Japan. In Japan, those characters are probably recognizable.
Oh, Marth's iconic.
Sure. So, you know, here, you know, I don't know if that would have led to it, but I mean, it was an interesting move. It was cool.
Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to wrap up the mid-era examples there and move into the more modern ones. And this is where, actually, all four of my examples here, these games really start to kind of merge strategy with other genres. This became really fashionable for people to experiment with genre fusions that involve strategy. And probably, you know, in an attempt to make up for some of these turnoffs that people had about it, like they're too slow or they involve too many tutorials, the rules are too complicated.
Or they're really more suited for a keyboard and mouse.
Yeah, yeah. Probably the correct order to take these in is we should probably start out by talking about Pikmin, which I think, again, like Advance Wars, introduced real-time strategy to a lot of people who'd never played a game like that before. And I know it sounds like there's a little bit of debate about whether this is really a strategy game.
Well, I don't know if there's a debate. I don't think that anyone really convinced me that there were strategy elements in that game. Like, to me, it feels more like an adventure game.
I agree.
It seems like people say it's real-time strategy. Look at all the units you have. But that's a little bit like, you know, like, do you call ammo and a gun clip units? I mean, because that's how they act, really. They're weapons.
To me, the Pikmin aren't units. They're resources. So,
yeah.
It's like almost like calling a game like Minecraft a strategy game. You literally harvest these things from the ground and then dispose of them in a way that makes them seem not particularly important in terms of their long-term survivability.
Well, you have units in a strategy game that are, you know, these are my disposable dudes.
Everybody is your disposable. But I don't literally throw my mechanized units in Advance Wars at the other enemies' heads.
No, but I think that's kind of just a funny commentary by Miyamoto on strategy games, you know, rather than shooting something, rather than having soldiers shooting things at each other, or even shooting arrows, you know, which kind of have the same kind of trajectory. In this case, you're literally going to throw these things. And, you know, the fact that they're living creatures that you're attacking with is, you know, I think it is potentially a commentary on other strategy games, but it's also just a very cute look at it. I
just don't find the game to be particularly strategic. I think that's the biggest reason I have a difficulty calling it a strategy game, is that there's not much strategic thinking involved. It's mostly just collect up on a crap ton of Pikmin.
I think it is.
The resource management is very, very limited, and you can't really multitask in a game. Like,
you can in Pikmin 2.
Yeah, Pikmin 2, because you can split it up, and plus there is resource management, because especially when you have to get specific colored Pikmin that have specific abilities. Like, I didn't play too much of Pikmin 2 until the Wii version. And, you know, I was actually pretty surprised, you know, because you're splitting between Olimar and Louie, and you can do two things at the same time. But not only that, but, you know, I think this is what actually turned me off about the game, but like, you know, okay, so you need your white Pikmin to do this, or you need your blue Pikmin to do this, but then if they're dead, you know, or if you all of a sudden, like, screw up and, like, just one fell swoop, like, bam, like, all of your dudes are dead, then you have to go and harvest them again, you know? And that's very strategic, I think, or very much like a strategy game.
To me, it feels more adventure-y because, oh, I mean, first off, they're not coming for you. There's no risk of being overrun by giant ladybugs.
But I think if Pikmin actually had like a competitive multiplayer mode, then it would be more like what you're talking about, James. Because the thing is, because it's really primarily a single player mode, you're going into these environments that are already populated with enemies at certain places, you know, and it is about navigating that also and exploring it. But it's not going to be like a competing army because of the setting, you know. You're fighting these creatures that are just indigenous life forms.
I think that's what makes it appealing, though, because it does have adventure elements. Like, you're experiencing new areas and different challenges that those environments, you know, give you.
My point is more that it feels much, if I had to put a name on that franchise, or I had to put genre typing on that franchise, I would not go strategy. I would definitely be inclined to go adventure. Even if you gave me a second type, I'd probably go, I mean, assuming that we accept the hybridization action-adventure, which is one of the most difficult to define genres ever.
I hate that phrase.
Even if we accept that phrase as a singular entity and apply it there, I would still think the second one I'd pick is more puzzle-solving.
I'm shocked. I've never known that this was even questionable. And Billy, you know, I wonder if the reason you and I are kind of on the same page here is because we were in the gaming press back when this game was first shown.
Sure.
And we were more directly exposed to the propaganda from Nintendo.
I was wondering if you were going to use that word, propaganda.
It's a long time ago, but I recall Nintendo was very forward about calling this a strategy game, and they really wanted to push that, like, this is a very, you know, it's our new genre, and we're trying to tell you what kind of game it is, because it's not quite like anything you've played before. But I remember it just constantly being referred to as a real-time strategy game, by the press, by Nintendo even. I've always thought about it that way. It was Nintendo's weird twist on real-time strategy.
Yeah, I don't remember if that's how Nintendo built it, but I think because of the circle, you know, when your cursor, it was kind of like how a mouse would work in an RTS for moving units in like StarCraft or something like that. I think a lot of the press were like, oh wow, I didn't like, this is a strategy game. Like, this is weird that, you know, this is from the mind of Miyamoto, you know, and like, I know definitely coming out at the first E3 when they debuted it and it was playable, I think a lot of people were really calling it that. But you know, it's definitely a different take on the strategy game for sure. Absolutely.
I wonder if the perception of this has even drifted over time. I don't know, because I haven't talked about Pikmin in that way, but really interesting. Anyway, we got to move on to other games, but Pikmin, of course, you know, we're seeing it again this year, eventually, and I'm excited to get back into it because it feels like I didn't play the Wii version of two when they brought it out because I had the original, so it feels like a long time since I played Pikmin, long time. But another game that came out a few years later that I think is really interesting is Battalion Wars. So this was the kind of the next game in Advance Wars to come out for Wii,
GameCube.
Yes. But instead of calling it GameCube Wars, they called it Battalion Wars, and it was made by a different studio, wasn't it? I think it was made by the Kuju guys.
Yep. Yeah, it was made by Europeans.
Yeah. So, and it was, you know, not a top-down strategy game, but a more of a 3D perspective, and was really kind of more real time in a lot of ways. Very, very drastic turn for the series, but it seemed to really have its fans.
Yeah, you said that, you know, at around this time, the strategy genre kind of started to innovate, but it's really a take on Battlezone, like the remake that Activision made like a couple of years before that.
Love Battlezone. Yeah, because like you're shooting things, but you're also resource managing and building units and stuff.
Yeah, and you are taking the role of, you know, one of your units. And you can go yourself and shoot at the enemies, and usually you give like some bonus to the units around you, and you usually do a better job than the AI would.
Yeah, like you essentially become a super unit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
While also managing all of the other units that are fighting alongside you.
It's not so much a orchestrate the order of battle as it is take over where the situation requires you to present mm-hmm. a more formidable opponent than the enemy is capable of countering.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting game. I mainly played it in E3 demos, unfortunately. I never really spent much time with the final copy, and it's a game I've often thought about kind of going back to and, you know, trying it with fresh eyes.
Yeah, it was unfortunate timing because the first game came out on GameCube, but very, very late.
Yeah, like 2005, maybe?
Yeah, it was.
So people had already kind of abandoned the console, and paying full price for what looked so cartoony when compared to, you know, the first-person shooters and other platforms. I think a lot of people were just like, really? Like, that's it? And didn't really give it a chance.
Be a good one for Retroactive one day. I think it's been in a poll maybe once, but should try to bring it back sometime. And then a game that came out on Wii fairly recently, just 2 or 3 years ago. James, you talked about it on the show once, of Sakura Wars.
Yeah.
And it's a long-running series that Sega had been making for a long time. It had never really come to America very much. But then, weirdly enough, this version for Wii that Sega made.
Put it out! Let's do this!
Yeah, it's really, really random. But again, this is a genre blender because this time they mix the strategy stuff with a dating sim.
Yeah, pretty much. So it's a much smaller, it's another tactical game. There's not a bunch of units. There's five of you. And that's it. I mean, that's the number of units there are. There are five. And you use them to essentially engage a large number of enemies. There's no leveling. There's no none of that. The only way they can improve their skill is by improving their interpersonal relationships. It's much like working in an office.
It's much like Fire Emblem Awakening.
A bit, yeah, but imagine if Fire Emblem Awakening had no level system.
Right, right. Not the same, but
basically it was there'd be a series of, you know, story events, which are essentially told through static cutscenes, and you pick your text response, and you go out and explore town, and then at the end of every chapter, there'd be, you know, sort of a monster of the week set up, and then at the end of every chapter, you fought a battle against said monster. and this proceeded on for some number of iterations until you got to the point where you fought the final boss. And the weird part of, well, everything is the weird part of that game. That game is weird. It's really good, though. It really is. I know it
oh,
sounds.
Oh, you loved it. I remember.
Yeah, it's really good. Is that it just feels like a very strange game as you're playing it, but you can kind of just get into it after a while. There are some differentiation in the capacity of the characters, but more or less they're relatively similar, and it's just kind of a fun, adventurous type of game. It's weird. It's so goddamn weird.
It seems very Japanese. That sounds so Japanese.
It's the most Japanese thing I own, and I have like 7 bottles of imported Japanese sake on the counter over there. That seems fake compared to this game.
I wonder if this was one of those poor, you know, late era kind of hardcore Wii games that sold about 3 copies, like Trauma Team.
I seem to recall that it did not well, but like surprisingly well for what we're dealing with here.
I might be completely wrong, but I think that the game came out on PS2 at the same time.
It did.
And the Wii version had like both Japanese and English tracks, and the PS2 version only had English, so.
Wii version had Japanese and English, but the PS2 version was the only one that was the special edition.
Are you sure it was PS2? Not PS3?
No, it's PS2, yes.
Who was buying PS2 games like 3 years ago?
I don't know, but the weird part is there's only the special edition. There is no standard edition.
That's crazy.
Remember, the launch PS3s were backwards compatible, so.
Yes.
Yeah.
This game, I mean, I was very much aware of this series, sort of a curiosity.
I knew it from Magic Box. You guys remember that site?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They used to do Japanese sales charts, and I used to go read it every week.
And it would always be up there. I'd be, what the fuck is this?
Well, there'd always be these kind of odd translations of game series that had never been westernized, so there was no correct translation, and so it'd just be done literally, and the names would make no sense whatsoever.
Godzilla, Sherlock Holmes, crossover, I don't know.
Yeah, so this one I was aware of in part because not only is it this really weird niche game that never came outside of Japan, but it also has this really super-duper devoted following in Japan that does all kinds of ridiculous stuff, like attends maid cafes designed after the setting of one of the games that came out 20 years ago. I mean, just super duper over the top fan base, the kind of stuff that gets online because it's so insane.
Well, Japan has a lot of themed everything. I mean, it's just, that's just the way, especially Tokyo.
They have a Dragon Quest bar.
They do have a Dragon Quest bar.
Yeah, I went to a Mario cocktail bar last time I was at Tokyo Game Show.
That's amazing.
I had some Bowser cocktail. It was weird. But fuck yeah, I was like, hell yeah, I want to go to this place. Who wouldn't?
Yeah. Like, oh, totally.
Awesome.
It's such a weird Japanese thing that I had become aware of it. So when I found out they're releasing one in the US, I'm like, well, hell, let's go. Sign me up for this.
So moving on, the last game that I had listed to talk about in advance, at least, is Pokemon Conquest. And I just thought this was interesting because it's a very late DS game. It just came out last year in 2012. And it blends Pokemon with, which is not a strategy game, really. It's more of a straight JRPG. But it blends it with Nobunaga's Ambition for some reason.
Because why not?
I didn't play it, although I heard it was really actually quite excellent. I think Josh Max from our staff absolutely loved the game.
It's supposed to be really good. Like, it's a really faithful Nobunaga's Ambition game.
Which means it's pretty hardcore strategy, right?
Yeah, they may have toned it down for the audience. Because, I mean, nobody playing that game has played Nobunaga's Ambition before.
That's no one. Almost guaranteed.
If there was a Venn diagram, there'd be a huge gap between the two. I mean, you take that and you take the recently announced Fire Emblem Shin Megami Tensei, like, whatever.
Yeah. We don't even know what kind of game that is.
I'm guessing it's going to be insane. It's a very odd crossover that doesn't make any sense until you realize there's money to be made here. And in Japan, there was probably a whole freaking lot of money to be made.
Sure. It makes perfect sense for Japan. And then you bring it stateside, and people just see Pokemon, and they're like, I'm in, you know?
I bet people in Japan bought multiple copies of that game. It's like, well, I want to patronize the Nobunaga's Ambition franchise and Pokemon. I'll buy one of each.
I think it did surprisingly well even in America.
It did, but I mean, at this point, anytime Pokemon's on a game, it's hard for me to contextualize doing surprisingly well.
Mm.
I mean, if it sold more copies than there were units of hardware, then yeah. But besides that, I don't know what the theoretical ceiling on a Pokemon's attach rate is at this point.
So just to wrap up the segment here, I just picked out Conquest there, but really in the past 2 or 3 years, there have actually been quite a few strategy games released on Nintendo platforms, some of them by third parties, especially on DS and 3DS, even a little bit of stuff in the eShop, I think. But I kind of wanted to ask you guys what you thought about what seems to me like a modern resurgence of strategy games, especially on consoles, because you got Fire Emblem Awakening seems to be doing really well. The critical response is outlandishly good.
Oh, yeah.
XCOM Enemy Unknown, which unfortunately is not on any Nintendo system, but is one of my favorite games of 2012 for sure. And I played it on PC with a controller. And I heard that the actual console versions were excellent as well. And that game was winning Game of the Year awards all over the place. So it seems like maybe strategy is kind of gaining a little bit of a foothold, and people are really into it right now.
I mean, XCOM is, again, it's a hybrid.
Somewhat, yeah. There's some simulation elements, for sure.
I don't know. It's hard for me to sort of characterize a resurgence, because, I mean, I was out there on the fringe watching, you know, these incredibly Japanese strategy RPGs that did come throughout the generation. A lot of them published by, you know, companies that make, you know, two games a year. So Axis dumped at least three Japanese strategy RPGs on the 360 of all systems. In just the most baffling confluence of things, this is a 360 exclusive Japanese RPG published by a company who misspelled their own name. To see them come out as in the context of larger titles, I don't know. I would be thrilled if there were more differentiation of the strategy genre without the sort of watering it down by making it sort of subordinate to another gameplay style.
Hmm.
I understand mixing gameplay styles to provide appeal. It's just when I play a game that's really more action than strategy, but it's being billed as, you know, a strategy action game, it feels a bit disingenuous. I'm going for something very different when I go to pick up a strategy game. When I pick up a strategy game, I want this very deliberate, intensive process where I'm sort of trying to map things out in my head. I treat it almost like a puzzle. I'm trying to figure out how best to crack open this problem.
The thing for me is that, like, I want more action. Like, I did play Advance Wars, but, like, there's a lot of strategy games that it just got too drawn out and too boring. And, like, I'm more of an action type gamer. Like, I just want more stuff happening. I want it more exciting. And, I know a lot of people like strategy games. That's cool. I could never really get into them. Advance Wars was, like, my first real a game that I really, really enjoyed. But once it got to the point where there was like 30 or 40 units or the too many, but like, once it got so long and so drawn out, like I got kind of bored. And, you know, so the more faster paced stuff is where I really, you know, granted, I'm not trying to plug Skulls again, but like,
no, you should. This is an appropriate time to do so.
You know, Skulls is a game that's more, it's definitely not as, It's still deep, but I mean, it doesn't get to the point where it just takes like half a day to get through, you know, one whole battle, you know, close to the end of the game. So
Skulls, from based on what I've played, which is not enough yet, but it's not really blended with action at all. It's just fast paced. You know, I think it's very, just as much of a pure strategy game as Advance Wars is, but it's just leaner, you know, in terms of the number of things you have to do per turn. And the units move faster, and they have a very convincing on-screen, you know, action play out rather than Advance Wars where it cuts away. So I just think it feels more immediate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I think the resurgence, I think it's exciting, you know. A game such as XCOM, you know, I think it's smart because, wow, you know, look at the user base right now on 360. You know, granted, I think publishers are nervous when you bring up real-time strategy, but, you know, you've got the franchise of XCOM. You had a killer kick-ass developer behind the game. You know, I don't think it's that big of a gamble, especially since there weren't too many of those games that came out.
Oh, and you're dealing with a franchise that has a certain amount of cachet.
It's a license.
Well.
Sure, sure, sure. You say XCOM, there's a lot of people that know that, and, you know, I think it did really well on PC, but I think it did really, really well on console, so, for that type of game.
That's awesome. Just to think that millions of Xbox owners are playing a turn, not even real-time like the Halo Wars or whatever it was, but a turn-based, old-school strategy game on their Xbox 360. That cracks me up. But it's a deserving game. It's fantastic.
I think that Advance Wars is basically the perfect strategy game because the maps are just small enough that you're not, you know, constantly running, you know, after one enemy that's evading you. Well, that happens a lot. And like, I remember playing Heroes of Might and Magic. Those games were bad when it came to that. Like, you had like such a big map and so few heroes to cover it. And good God. But yeah, Advance Wars keeps the pace going just because the conflict is smaller on each map, and the you know, just the energy of the presentation really helps, you know, like it's easier to swallow, you know.
With Fire Emblem, like, are you guys in the camp where this new Fire Emblem is breaking the rules of Fire Emblem because it's got the easy mode?
No, it's no. A mode. If you don't like it, don't play it that way.
But some, like, purists think that, you know, oh, that's not, you know, Fire Emblem is Fire Emblem, and it should be that. Hey, I just know
I'm not a fan of purists.
Well, I don't see why purists even would have a problem with the way that other people play a game.
Because there are people who think items should be off in Smash Brothers.
People like to bitch about everything. But I mean, like, for me, I think it's awesome. Like, that was the one thing that always irked me about Fire Emblem and a lot of strategy games where, you know, well, at least in Fire Emblem, like, when someone dies, they're gone. It's like, really? And, you know, I don't know how many times I reset it and replayed because I lost somebody. And, you know, but that's also what turned me off about strategy games, too, was that, you know, you'd play a battle for, like, an hour and a half and lose. You're like, fuck, that's an hour and a half. I just pissed away. I got to start over. And, like, you know, especially now that I'm older and I have limited time, you know, time is a resource for me too, you know. So, I mean, you know, pissing away an hour and a half is kind of frustrating. So I think it's actually nice that Fire Emblem has it this time around.
So, I mean, I'm as veteran as you can be, actually more veteran than you could realistically be of the series in the U.S. because I played a bunch of fan-translated Super Nintendo games before they came out here.
Wow, nice.
What a crazy man.
I actually am using the so-called casual mode because I don't let myself just be a complete dick and just be like, all right, whatever, I don't care if you die, get out there, be a diversion. Like, I talked about this last week, but if I lose characters hand over fist, I'm going to reset and start over again because I'm clearly doing something fucking wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, if I lose one character at the end of a 40-minute battle, no, I'm not resetting. I'm going to go ahead and continue. The loss of a character in Fire Emblem is doubly painful because not only are you losing a character who had a role in the context of the story, they're not nameless. There's no nameless pawns in this game like there are in Advance Wars. You're losing whatever material investment you've put into this character to develop them. And in many cases, that translates to not only real-world game money. Time and even enemies, kills in the Fire Emblem games are literally resources. Because you can run out of enemies to grind against.
That means you've won the game.
Well, except for the fact you may not still be able to beat the ones that you stick in front of you. But in Awakening, they actually mitigated that as well by having these constantly respawning enemies on the map you can go sort of brutalize for your experience bonuses.
And that idea is at least as old as Final Fantasy Tactics.
Yeah. To me, why it's almost preferable to use this mode is that I can actually save mid-battle in this mode. And if I do something really stupidly, disastrously dumb, I can reload that save, but I still had to learn the lesson. I still understand conceptually why what I did was a big bowl of dumb. It gives me all the punishment that I need to learn against, but it's not so brutal that I feel like I'm being beaten. It's experience, it's a taxing experience without being overly painful. And I think that incentivizes me enough to learn from my mistakes, but doesn't make me want to hate the game.
All right. Well, we're going to have to wrap up the episode, guys. So thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the discussion on strategy. And Billy, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad I could be back on.
And good luck with the game. I know I'm enjoying it, and we'll keep playing it. Hopefully we'll talk about it in New Business on an episode very soon. So before we go completely, I wanted to remind everyone that you can send your emails to the show with rfn@nintendoworldreport.com or use the link in the show notes on the website. And also wanted to announce that we have put up our retroactive 26th poll. That's the 26th time we've done this.
My God.
That's a lot of games that we've played specifically for the podcast. But anyway, the poll is up, and there are 5 games this time. There's not really a theme. I just took most of the suggestions from the nominations thread in the forum.
The theme is they were nominated in the forum.
Yeah. but your options are Dracula X, Rondo of Blood, Ease Book 1 and 2, Pulse Man, Zombies Ate My Neighbors, and Star Tropics 2. So if any of those sound remotely interesting to you, or if you just want to read up what everyone else is saying, maybe make your decision after that, you can head over to the forum thread. Again, there will be a link in the show notes for this, or you can follow us on the various social networks and you'll hear it there. I mean, I even posted something on Miiverse.
Did you post it in the new Zelda channel?
No, it's in Funky Barn.
Everything in Funky Barn.
Fuck yeah, dude. That's where all the cool kids hang.
That's right.
Funky Barn, the official chat room of Wii U.
I just threw up my promotional graffiti on the Miiverse wall.
Oh, that's so awesome. I'm going to have to post it there.
It is one of the best parts of the Wii U launch, was just seeing people post, I don't even think about Funky Barn, but this place is great.
All right, so that's it. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Later.
Bye.
Thanks, Lindy, for not showing up, you jerk.
Bald bastard.
We'll get in trouble with someone somewhere if we don't mention it, so Gladius, it existed.
Oh, yeah.
It was pretty good.
That's a cool game. Yeah, for GameCube.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First this week, we have a review, Brain Age Concentration Training by Tyler Olu. Get your bonfires ready. Brain training is back in Serving the Devil. Turns out demonic reading is a bit less sacrilegious and a bit more enjoyable than you'd expect.
We have Impressions, Lego City Undercover for the Wii U by Carmine Red. A game that probably began life as Lego Law & Order Los Angeles. Carmine takes us to the dirty plastic streets to explore the open world crime-busting title.
I really wish this game were Lego Law & Order Los Angeles. It'd be the confluence of multiple brands. It just makes no sense.
Next up, we have a review mini of 99 Moves by Dave Miller, who is our old friend Synaptic, who used to write into the show a lot. Anyway, enjoy Up Games, purveyors of such 99 titles as 99 Bullets and 99 Seconds,
smelling a theme,
have now created 99 Moves, a game where you get 99 moves. It's functional, but it doesn't seem to do much with the move limit.
It's a sterling review.
And finally this week, we have a review for Disney Epic Mickey 2 on the Wii U by Mike Sklens. Last stop on the Epic Mickey 2 monorail doesn't take this game to the Magic Kingdom. Turns out the lack of Mickey pointer controls, generic gameplay, and the lack of off-screen mode can't be made up for by the slathering of Disney charm. And you can find all of this great original content, plus a lot more.
A ton of news from the Nintendo Direct.
From the Nintendo Directs. And there's another one coming up right after this episode goes up. So you can catch all of that over at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Welcome back. So, as you probably heard earlier, this is actually a one-segment show. The only reason I'm recording this is we have no idea what to do with a now-playing segment in a one-segment show. Normally it goes in the middle, between segment A and segment B. So, this is actually the end of the show. So, after I finish talking, is going to come the conclusion music for the show, and then an excellent stinger recorded right in this segment. Enjoy.
And finally this week, we have a review for Disney Epic Mickey 2 on the Wii U by Mike Sklens. Last stop on the Epic Mickey 2 monorail. Jesus.
I'm really proud of this one.
Monorail.
I'm really happy
with this. I gotta
say
this with a straight face. Last... Last stop on the Epic Mickey 2 monorail doesn't take this game to the Magic Kingdom. Turns out the lack of Mickey pointer controls, generic gameplay, and the lack of off-screen mode can't be made up for by the slathering of Disney charm.